This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Supreme Court, under Chief Justice John Roberts, is more conservative than any other in a half century. George W. Bush and his team of lawyers will be shaping the direction of American law and culture long after many of them are dead, writes Jan Crawford Greenberg. Greenberg's new book about the Rehnquist Court and the new Roberts Court is called Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the United States Supreme Court. She's covered the court since 1994. She's currently legal correspondent for ABC News. She's been a legal analyst for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS and was the legal affairs correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Jan Crawford Greenberg, welcome to Fresh Air. What were you looking for in this book? What were you trying to evaluate?
One of the most, I think, puzzling things for people who followed the court is why the Rehnquist Court, a court that had seven Republican-appointed justices, became, in many ways, a legal and ideological disappointment for conservatives. You know, why did that happen? Why was this a court with seven Republican-appointed justices that refused to overturn Roe, that refused to ban affirmative action, that outlawed school prayer? I mean, on case after case that conservatives cared about, this was a court that let them down.
Do you think this was one of the most ideologically selected courts in the history of the court?
Republican presidents for decades, dating back to Ronald Reagan, have tried to influence the direction of the court. Reagan campaigned on appointing justices who would start undoing some of the liberal legacy of the Warren Court. But in case after case, the justices that they nominated were not as conservative as those presidents had hoped, or those that were conservative, like Justice Thomas, for example, affected the court in unexpected ways.
Well, there's one particular unexpected way that you describe with Clarence Thomas. Let me ask you to describe it.
Well, Justice Thomas, when he came on the court, was a forceful conservative voice, very independent. Of course, the storyline on Justice Thomas in those first couple months, and even years later, the storyline has persisted, you know, that he was following Justice Scalia, that he was a clone of Scalia, that Scalia was basically telling Thomas what to do. That's one of the most interesting things that I discovered in doing research into the Blackmun papers, the papers of Justice Harry Blackmun. Thomas, when he first came on the court, from the first week on the bench, was this independent, forceful voice who stood alone. And if any justice that year was changing his votes, it was Scalia changing his votes to join Justice Thomas. And of course, that's not what anyone assumed or reported. And still, that kind of stereotype lingers today. But that had an unexpected impact on the Supreme Court. Justice Thomas's views, the forcefulness of his views, caused Justice O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor, to shift to the left. So that term, Thomas's first term, when everyone, liberals and conservatives alike, thought the court was really going to start undoing all these liberal landmarks like Roe versus Wade, separation of church and state. They had a big school prayer case that year. That year, the court went inexplicably to the left because Justice Thomas, coming on, replacing this liberal icon, Thurgood Marshall, caused Justice O'Connor to back away.
What makes you think that there was a cause and effect there, that it was Thomas that caused O'Connor to move more toward the left?
In the Blackmun papers, there are memos and documents that have never really been publicly released, so we get a good feel for some of the behind-the-scenes discussion in the writings that the justices have. And that term, Justice O'Connor, in document after document and memo after memo, is responding to Justice Thomas and almost bristling on paper. You can see her words as she's just having this kind of visceral shying away from the forcefulness of his views. So it's very evident from looking at the documents and also from interviews I did with people who were inside the court from that term. Now, Justice O'Connor is an interesting justice to watch because, you know, we think of her as the moderate. She was the justice who, as she went, so went the court. And for many years, people who've clerked for Justice O'Connor and followed the court before Thomas got on believe that she was staying to the right because of liberal stalwart William Brennan. And so when Brennan stepped down from the court the year before Thomas went on, you know, that force field was gone. So that enabled her to again move further to the left once Thomas came on.
Now, you were talking about how the Rehnquist Court was a disappointment to conservatives. And, you know, an example of that is Justice Kennedy, who didn't prove to be as conservative as the conservatives behind his appointment hoped. And you give examples of two decisions in which he changed his mind in, like, toward the very end of the case, and he seemed to be on one side and then switched to another. Can you talk about one of those decisions?
Sure, and this was the pivotal term, the 1991 term, when Justice Thomas joined the court. And that was a term when we really saw the chess pieces rearranged, and the term that the court started moving to the left. In those two cases, that term, I mean, these were the issues that conservatives cared most about, abortion and in school prayer. And in both cases, Justice Kennedy initially sided with the conservatives, but at the end of the day, you know, he changed his vote and went over to the liberal side. In both of those cases, the first case was an abortion case, and the court was being asked to overturn Roe. And instead, it really put Roe on more solid ground. We had Justice O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy joining together and refusing to set aside that landmark decision. The other case was a school prayer case. The court was being asked to allow student-led prayers at graduation ceremonies. Justice Kennedy actually was going to write that opinion for the conservatives to allow the school prayer. But as he started working through the opinion, he was in a quandary. He couldn't make the opinion right, as he would describe it. So he went to the Chief Justice, William Rehnquist, and said, I just can't write this opinion. I've changed my mind. I think that the prayers are unconstitutional. And Rehnquist, the conservative, who of course felt very strongly that these student-led prayers were in fact permissible under the Constitution, really had nothing that he could do. So he said, well, go ahead and circulate your opinion. And of course, Justice Kennedy ended up writing the opinion for the liberals to strike down those student-led prayers at graduation ceremonies.
You reprint what I think is a very interesting memo that Kennedy wrote to Justice Blackmun during the abortion case that you were talking about. And this was Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which was going to put restrictions on abortion and you say possibly even strike down Roe v. Wade. And so when he changes his mind, when he decides that he can't side with the conservatives on this, he writes Justice Blackmun a note. And Justice Blackmun wrote the Roe v. Wade decision. And the note that you reprint says, "Dear Harry, I need to see you as soon as you have a few free moments. I want to tell you about some developments in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and at least part of what I say should come as welcome news. If today is not convenient, I'll be here tomorrow. Give me a call. Yours, Tony." Is that a typical kind of memo? Did that memo seem very unusual to you?
It seemed unusual to me, and it certainly seemed unusual to people inside the court, including Justice Scalia, who believed that Kennedy was a solid vote for the conservative side. Justice Scalia had a sense that Justice Kennedy might have been wavering in the case, so he actually went to see Justice Kennedy, and the two had a walk around their neighborhood where they both live, and he believed that Kennedy was going to remain a solid vote. But then within a couple of days, it became clear to everyone inside the court that Kennedy was, in fact, going to side with the more liberal side and vote to uphold Roe.
Well, Kennedy wasn't really the conservatives' first choice for that seat in the court anyways, was he?
He wasn't. And this is one of the, I think, great untold stories about Justice Kennedy. Conservatives now believe that Kennedy really drifted left once he got on the court. And he did to some extent. I mean, he has changed over the years. But there was a core group of conservatives in the Reagan Justice Department who from the beginning believed that Anthony Kennedy was not a solid conservative, and they went to great lengths to block his nomination. It's just a fascinating story. I mean, after the nomination of Robert Bork went up in flames, Anthony Kennedy was waiting in the wings. He looked like he was going to be the next nominee. He was a federal appeals court judge out in California. But this group of lawyers in the Justice Department who had read his opinions from his time on the bench believed that he was not the kind of conservative that Ronald Reagan wanted to nominate. So they mounted this campaign to, in effect, sabotage his nomination. They called senators on the Hill and said that Reagan had, you know, narrowed it down to Anthony Kennedy and whoever the senator's favorite nominee was. So the senator would call the White House and say, anybody but Anthony Kennedy. They enlisted the help of the former Attorney General, William French Smith, who called President Reagan and said, you know, I don't think Tony Kennedy is the man that you say that you want to nominate. And so they were able to persuade President Reagan and his top advisors to nominate another judge after Robert Bork went down, an untested, largely unknown figure named Douglas Ginsburg. And of course, Douglas Ginsburg nomination, he was never formally nominated. It lasted only a matter of days because Nina Totenberg from NPR unearthed evidence of pretty recent or some marijuana use in his past. And so he was forced to step down. And then Kennedy, there was nothing else that people felt that they could do at that point. But these lawyers in the Justice Department knew from reading his opinions that Kennedy was not going to be that kind of solid conservative. In fact, one of the opinions really foreshadowed some of the positions that he would later take on the bench as a Supreme Court justice. He was perfectly comfortable citing, for example, a United Nations resolution. And Kennedy today is a great source of frustration to conservatives because he's willing to look outside the United States. I mean, he'll look to international law. Conservatives don't think that you should do that on the court. So they had clues about Kennedy, and they knew Kennedy was going to probably let them down, and they were right.
My guest is Jan Crawford Greenberg, legal affairs correspondent for ABC News. Her new book is called Supreme Conflict. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is ABC News legal correspondent Jan Crawford Greenberg. Her new book is called Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the U.S. Supreme Court. When we left off, we were talking about how President Reagan ended up appointing Anthony Kennedy to the Supreme Court. Well, let's jump ahead to President George H.W. Bush. Who were the people who were advising him on who to choose to fill vacant Supreme Court seats?
The first President Bush, his White House counsel, Boyden Gray, and his Attorney General, Dick Thornburgh, were heavily involved in the process, as was his chief of staff, John Sununu. When President Bush got a nomination, William Brennan notified the White House that he would be stepping down. Bush wanted to move quickly. He did not want the seat to hang open. He believed that Reagan had waited too long in nominating Robert Bork, so that gave Democrats time to really gather their troops and fire quickly when the nomination came down. So he told his advisors that he wanted a name within 48 hours. He was going to make this nomination very quickly after the vacancy came open, or the seat came open. So the lawyers in the White House counsel's office, led by Boyden Gray, assumed that the nominee would be Kenneth Starr, who was the Solicitor General, a very highly regarded legal mind. The White House had lured him off the D.C. Circuit, the Federal Court of Appeals in Washington, to be Solicitor General. And they had told him, you know, he was going to be on the shortest of the short list for the Supreme Court. Nothing was promised. Starr certainly didn't think it was a quid pro quo thing that he was leaving the Federal Appeals Court and then he might be on the short list. But in the White House and in the White House counsel's office, it was clear that Starr was the front runner and Starr was going to be the nominee. But when the advisors gathered for an early morning breakfast, it was a Saturday morning, the next day after Brennan's resignation letter got to the White House, Bush held this meeting with his White House counsel, his attorney general, his chief of staff. And before coffee was even poured, Attorney General Dick Thornburgh kind of startled the group by saying, you know, Starr is unacceptable.
Why was Starr some people's favorite, and why was he unacceptable to Attorney General Thornburgh?
Well, when we think about Kenneth Starr now, what we think about is Whitewater and his pursuit of President Clinton. He's become a quite polarizing figure, of course. But back then, Starr was a highly regarded federal judge and considered a very affable, first-rate legal mind and colleague. But there were lawyers in the Justice Department who believed Starr, and this is almost incredible to believe now, but who thought that Starr was too squishy, that he could drift to the left once he got on the court, like they thought that Kennedy had done. And so they worried that Starr was not conservative enough. They thought, you know, his views were unfocused, particularly, you know, on the law. Two of Thornburgh's deputies, Bill Barr and Mike Luttig, who would down the road become a possible Supreme Court nominee himself, actively opposed Starr's nomination. They would find Starr incredibly, you know, annoying after his briefings. They thought he was verbose and meandering. And so they opposed him because they thought that he was not going to be a solid enough conservative vote. And Thornburg agreed. Now, of course, the great irony of that is that it paved the way for David Souter, who on this Supreme Court is perhaps the most liberal justice of the nine.
Yeah, why was Souter considered to be such a big blunder by conservatives?
Because David Souter has become and very quickly became the most liberal voice on the Supreme Court. And it's hard for conservatives to see how a president who nominated Clarence Thomas could have so egregiously misjudged David Souter. George Bush said he wanted to nominate conservative judges. He was following on the heels of Ronald Reagan, who also had tried to nominate conservative justices to the Supreme Court. Bush thought that he was nominating a conservative in David Souter. His advisors, even in the White House, had advised him that David Souter would be a predictable conservative, that he had a view of the Constitution, that the court wouldn't be involved in contentious social debates like abortion and you know, on gay rights, civil rights. So they believed, if you can believe this, that David Souter was going to be a solid conservative. They were obviously wrong. And after Souter's first year on the court, his views became very clear. So conservatives see that Souter, when we think about how the Supreme Court, the Rehnquist Court, became that court, conservatives see Souter as just a mistake, whereas they see Kennedy as someone who maybe have been a mistake, but who also changed, kind of a hybrid. But with Souter, he was really no conservative from the beginning. You know, he had only been on the federal bench just a very short time, hadn't even written an opinion. So they believe that Souter may have thought he thought those things, but he didn't know himself. He didn't have a conservative legal philosophy. He didn't have a conservative legal framework. His advisors, Bush's advisors, told him that he was conservative, and maybe in New Hampshire, he seemed like he would have been conservative. But once he got to the Supreme Court, it became clear that he was not conservative. Souter also tipped his hand during his confirmation hearings. He responded to questions from Democratic senators. He, in a way that the advisors watching these hearings in the White House told me that they just started having a sinking feeling that they had made a terrible mistake. They watched Souter heap praise on William Brennan, the man he was replacing, in a way that suggested that he hoped that he could kind of live up to what the liberal justice had done. So he tipped his hand a little bit. The first term on the court, he looked like he might be conservative, but by his second year, it was very clear that he was going to be firmly in the liberal wing.
Let's skip ahead to one of the most controversial decisions of the Rehnquist Court, and I'm referring to Bush v. Gore. You write about Kennedy's place in that decision, and I want to ask you to tell us what you learned about his place.
Sure. Now, of course, Bush versus Gore, when we talk about the Rehnquist Court and how it became a disappointment to conservatives, you know, obviously, this is still a court that five of its justices joined together and voted to stop the Florida recount, which delivered the election to George W. Bush. But that decision opened the court to charges that it was deciding the case on politics, not on the law. And certainly academics believe, and the evidence is there, that that decision actually forced the court further to the left in the years after Bush versus Gore, and particularly Justices Kennedy and O'Connor, those two moderates, that after that decision, they didn't want to be seen as partisans or casting predictable votes for the right. Justice Kennedy is a justice who, you know, his vote was sometimes always in play. He was someone who would change his mind. He was someone who would take a position, think it through, decide it didn't work for him, and then take another position. And the justices knew that. So two of the more liberal justices, Justice Souter and Breyer, believed that they could get Kennedy's vote. So they, you know, began working on Justice Kennedy, trying to convince him that there was another approach to take, that this case could be decided on grounds of equal protection grounds, and that the standardless recount in Florida would violate those equal protection concerns, but there was a way to do them the right way, and the recounts could continue. So they tried to get Justice Kennedy's vote, but as a result, what happened was the court at the end of the day kind of came out with a mess. I mean, Kennedy ended up being responsible for this opinion that these standardless recounts did violate equal protection concerns, but that the recounts had to stop. Kennedy refused to go along with Breyer and the liberals to say that the recounts could continue. So, but he refused to sign on to a more clear and legally defensible position from the conservative point of view that Chief Justice William Rehnquist had written. So that decision and the way it came about really, at the end of the day, didn't serve the court very well.
Jan Crawford Greenberg is a legal affairs correspondent for ABC News. Her new book about the Supreme Court is called Supreme Conflict. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jan Crawford Greenberg, the author of the new book, Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for control of the U.S. Supreme Court. It examines how the Rehnquist Court was shaped and how the Roberts Court is taking shape. What do you feel you've learned so far about Chief Justice Roberts? Do you feel like you truly have gotten demonstrations of his judicial philosophy in action yet?
Not completely yet. This will be a quite interesting term for the court because they've got some pretty significant cases on abortion, affirmative action, and the environment. But I think Chief Justice Roberts has been pretty clear from the beginning, even back to his confirmation hearings, in outlining what he sees as a very conservative view of the courts, a very conservative view of the judicial role. He thinks courts should have a more limited place in society. That's a view that's clearly shared by Justice Scalia. I think that what we'll see, though, is Roberts is going to be a more effective Chief Justice, perhaps a more conservative Chief Justice than Rehnquist and a more effective Chief Justice than Rehnquist, because he wants to build consensus and coalition. He's got, he's got good people skills. I mean, remember from the confirmation hearings, he wowed the senators with his ability to explain the law and kind of this smooth, easygoing manner that he exhibited. So I think Roberts will be quite effective, but I also think that we're going to see Roberts taking quite conservative positions.
So you think he'll be more effective in getting other justices to side with his conservative views?
Well, he only needs one. He needs Anthony Kennedy. And I do think he will be more effective in getting Kennedy to side with his views and those of the court's more solid conservatives than Chief Justice William Rehnquist was. You know, Rehnquist ended up disappointing conservatives, including conservatives on the Supreme Court. When he started out as an associate justice, Rehnquist often was the lone dissenter. In fact, his clerks gave him a little Lone Ranger doll that he kept in his chambers. But when he became chief, it seemed to people on the court, justices on the court, in fact, that Rehnquist started caring less about the reasoning and more about the result, more about the outcome. Roberts is not going to be like that. I mean, Roberts is more principled and more disciplined in his approach to the law, and that will have, I think, a significant impact on the court and on the development of the law.
But do you think Kennedy will be swayed by Chief Justice Roberts' opinion?
Yes, I do. And I think one of the things that we're seeing now is, you know, Roberts has given a lot of talks, and he had a very interesting interview recently with Jeff Rosen in The Atlantic. And also when I spoke with the Chief Justice in Miami back in November, he talked at length about the need to have consensus on the court, the need to try to reach unanimity more often, the need to have more narrow opinions, not to write so broadly. And I think that is an appealing way to think about bringing the court together and keeping Justice Kennedy from being such a pivotal vote. I'm not saying that's what Roberts' intent is, but it certainly seems to me that that's a way that the court could move in that direction, together more, write more narrow opinions. And so then you don't have Kennedy, kind of everyone playing for Justice Kennedy's vote, as we saw with O'Connor.
What are some of the cases coming up that you think will really test the court and demonstrate how it's functioning?
I think perhaps the biggest case this term is certainly the one that we're all most interested in watching how the court resolves it. And the one that will really test Roberts' leadership is an abortion case. It's a challenge to a federal law that banned an abortion procedure that opponents call partial birth abortion. Now, the court just a few years ago struck down state laws that banned partial birth abortion, but the case was 5-4, and Justice O'Connor had the deciding vote. Kennedy voted with the conservatives in that case. He would have allowed the state regulation. So now, with Alito taking O'Connor's seat, the court appears poised to uphold this federal partial birth abortion ban, which means, of course, the court will be going in a very different direction. Kennedy's opinion in that case a few years ago when the court struck down those state laws was fascinating because it goes back to the decision in 1992 in Casey when he went and joined O'Connor and Souter and refused to overturn Roe. His opinion in the state partial birth abortion case suggests that he really felt he had been had, that when he agreed with the more liberal justices back in Casey, he thought it still meant that states would have an important role, that the government would have an important role in allowing some restrictions or regulation on abortion. And so in his view, that's exactly the kind of thing, that's exactly the kind of deal that they had struck back in Casey. So his opinion was just outraged, and I think it'll be very difficult for Justice Kennedy to walk away from that now, to change his mind and now say that the federal law should be struck down.
What are the most controversial parts of the late-term abortion or partial birth abortion, as it's known by its critics? What are the most controversial parts of this federal law?
Well, this federal law does not contain an exception to allow doctors to perform it to protect the mother's health. And that is what opponents of the law say just dooms it and makes it flatly unconstitutional. So how the court resolves that will go a long way in giving us a sense of how conservative this Roberts Court is going to be, whether or not the justices believe that that health exception is critical. Of course, Justice O'Connor, she believed firmly that any restrictions or regulations on abortion had to have that health exception.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Jan Crawford Greenberg is a legal affairs correspondent for ABC News. Her new book about the Supreme Court is called Supreme Conflict. This is Fresh Air.